This is an ABC podcast.
This is the South Australian Country Hour on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
Hello, you're listening to the Country Hour this spring Monday. My name's Isabella Pittaway. Thanks very much for your company. Coming up in the next 10 minutes, are you confused about how the water market works? Well, now there's an app for that. Also, this lunchtime, what if I told you we could be popping broccoli or Brussels sprout pills in the future? Sounds healthy, right? And it could also be the solution to the horticulture industry's waste problem.
It's pretty big ask to say to someone here, just take this pill and it's a broccoli pill. But in the future, who knows?
That story is coming up after the weather, and the Bureau will today talk us through the winter that was. But first today on the Country Hour, the York Peninsula Council has written to Premier Stephen Marshall opposing two proposed plans which would see snapper fishing banned for 3 years. Consultation for the proposed snapper ban ended last week, but the council says the three-week timeframe for consultation was unreasonable. I spoke to Mayor Darren Braund earlier.
Well, we've formulated a letter on behalf of our council. In it, I suppose, are some thoughts from different parts of our community, individuals, charter operators, professional fishermen, tourism operators, caravan park operators, business people. We've formulated a letter mainly to express opposition for the three-year closure, requesting that the government open the dialogue and maybe look at some different options to deal with the issue. We believe that the snapper issue is something we need to address and address quickly, but are opposed to a blanket three-year ban.
Why is the council opposed to the three-year snapper ban?
Probably for a few reasons. We're particularly concerned about the effect it might have on our local economy, our tourism operators, even our charter operators, professional fishermen, along with our even our cafes, accommodation providers, just the whole economy of the York Peninsula.
How concerned are you by it, by the proposed closure?
Part of the issue was we only have 3 weeks' notice. We found out about it. By an article in the Advertiser and had 3 weeks to get a submission in. And we don't feel like that is probably a consultation that is needed for an issue like this. We think it's a very important issue to manage the snapper stocks as well as all other fish, but feel there needs to be much wider dialogue about the issue to move it forward. And just a two options, which for us is just a long ban, other options needs to be discussed as well.
And you've put in this letter to the Premier, you've put forward some of your own suggestions for other options to look at trying to restore the snapper population or at least address the shortages. What are those options?
Some options could be an altered bag limit, longer seasonal closures, maybe a shorter ban to start with. I heard about a ban of 12 months in New Zealand, which was seemed to be effective in their situation. So there's a few different options they could look at.
What would you say to those people that say, you know, the ban isn't long enough, it should be longer so that the species can be protected?
Well, I would say that, you know, I'd like to see some more resources and budget put into the science of it. And I respect the scientists that are working on this, but I believe they need to have probably more resources so we can have some even better quality science going forward to manage this issue properly.
You're not the first person to raise concerns around the science of this. What is it particularly that the council is concerned about when it comes to the science around these snapper numbers?
Well, there's probably a couple of things I've noticed, and these have been secondhand, things I've heard, so I don't know the validity of them, but I heard that under the Labor government, the previous government, the budget was cut to resource the science of this, and I'd like to have confidence that every available resource is given to that to make sure we have quality data. Some of the people, professional fishermen, I've heard from are questioning the interpretation of that data, so we would like to see that that's looked into properly to make sure that we are getting the right information from the data that is collected. So there just seems to be a few questions over that whole area, and we need to have a scientific community that are resourced properly, that can do their job properly in a right amount of time and make sure they have the budgets to do that.
That was York Peninsula Mayor Darren Braund. Well, what do you think about this snapper ban? It's been 3 weeks since the government announced it. How are you feeling about it? Have you changed your mind about whether you think this three-year ban should go ahead? And do you think 3 weeks is adequate time for consultation? It's 6 weeks for the GM ban being lifted, but the government here giving 3 weeks for discussion on the snapper ban. You can send me a text with your thoughts to 0467 922 783, or you can give me a call on 1300 222 891. Well, water and the Murray-Darling Basin Plan has been a hot-button talking point for people throughout many regions. And the Minister for Water, David Littleproud, is travelling through the Southern Basin this week with the Interim Inspector General of the MDB, Mick Kilty, and they've been meeting with farmers and locals who have been talking about their concerns. They were near Renmark this morning, and Mr Littleproud spoke earlier with Hamish McDonald on RN Breakfast.
No, there's a frustration about the fact there is a dwindling amount of water because it hasn't rained. And obviously people grasp at different things about what the cause of that is, but there has been some lack of confidence around compliance measures, particularly in the north. And that's what I clearly articulated around why we originally brought Mick in to look after the northern basin, but now to extend it right across the basin is to make sure people know that everybody is doing the right thing. And if they're not, they're going to get called out. And the states have done some work on that, and we're now going to have an overarching person through Mick Kilty as the Interim Inspector General to make sure there's even greater confidence, and we can build that confidence between state borders and between farmers. That's where there's been a lack of confidence as I get around. I hear that someone's stealing water up above them.
You mentioned it yourself. Mick Kilty has talked about the system being ripe for corruption. Do you believe that there is corruption in the system when it comes to the Murray-Darling Basin plant?
Well, look, I think it'd be naive to think there isn't. The reality is when you have a program such as this, $13 billion, a human nature is that someone always tries to cut corners. And unless you have a good regulator and someone looking out and making sure you don't let them cut those corners, invariably they'll do that. Whether it's the Murray-Darling Basin Plan, whether it's live trade, whether it's anything, you always find people trying to cut corners to make more money. And to take advantage of a system, a program of this scale by government. And that's why we've got to put the right people in place to give confidence, not just to the Australian public, but to the government itself. This is a big spend. This is Australia's biggest environmental program ever undertaken. And we've got to make sure we do this right. And there's been some mistakes. You can't run away from that. You've got to look it in the eye and say, yep, there has been some misgivings in the past. We've got to face up to them front on, look people in the eye and say we're going to fix it. And that's what Mick's job is to fix it.
There's been a lot of discussion about the water efficiency program. Can the federal government provide the public with a full list of the projects under that $4 billion plan?
For the on-farm projects you're talking about?
Yeah.
Yeah, we've actually provided those to Senator Rex Patrick, who asked them through Senate questions. So they are all there to be provided. The cost of those programs, the on-farm projects, cost around $4,400 a megalitre. The average price at the moment is, for high security, somewhere between $5,000 and $7,000 a megalitre. So that's good value for money. But the important piece on this, Hamish, is that it doesn't impact on the towns like buybacks. Direct buybacks have destroyed communities. So what we're doing now, and we're 80% of the way through this plan, the last 20%, this is the exciting bit about this for whatever good can come out of this plan, is the last 20% is now to be done through the smarts of the 21st century, through infrastructure rather than buybacks. We've got 36 projects to complete. If we get those done, we can get the hell out of people's lives and give them certainty. The 2.6 million Australians who just want certainty, want government out of their lives, we can complete it. And we can complete it with the smarts rather than buybacks, which have destroyed communities. The on-farm infrastructure projects have created efficiencies and given water back to the environment, which is what we have always said this plan was about. 20% of agricultural water has gone back to the environment. We've done that, and now we're not going to get into farmers' lives or communities' lives. We're going to use it with the smarts of the 21st century. And that's a good thing. We should back ourselves to do that.
I want to ask you about something you've seen on this trip. You visited an almond property at Renmark in South Australia, as I understand it. Almonds have come to symbolise the pressure that's being placed on the river system. There's been an explosion in plantings in recent years throughout the southern basin, but almonds consume an enormous amount of water. I think one hectare requires something like 12 to 13 megalitres a year. That's something like five Olympic swimming pools. Has the rapid growth of the almond industry been a mistake for this part of the basin?
Well, look, obviously, economics will drive the use of water. But can I congratulate Lisa Neville and this Victorian state government, who have taken steps, planning steps, and this lies with the states around what they do with their planning rules. And Lisa has taken preemptive steps in Victoria to protect and to stop some of these plantings happening down in parts of her basin. Other states can follow with this. And this is where some maturity from the states can continue. And Lisa Neville has led the way. And I congratulate her for that. I'll call it out. She's from the other side. I don't care. She's done a good job. She's done a damn good job in being proactive in this. And the other states can follow. And that's a decision they'll need to make. I've also put in place the ACCC to give them the responsibility to go and get underneath the bonnet of the water market. There are 14% of entitlement holders who don't own land. Now, is that the original intent of what we tried to achieve when we separated land from water to make it best use, most economical use of water back in the early 2000s? I think we need to understand how the market's evolved and whether there are now anomalies in that where brokers and other participants have overreached. Get an understanding of that, and then I have to work with the states because they invariably make up the rules in a lot of the water markets, but they've been pragmatic. At last Minco, we all said this was a good idea. Let's get an understanding of this and make sure there's no intended consequences. We're not putting small family farms out of business because of the evolution of this marketplace, but we need to do it methodically and sensibly to make sure there's no unintended consequences of those who are water entitlements at the moment, because it's an asset that they've gone to the bank and they lend against.
That was Water Minister David Littleproud speaking with Hamish McDonald on the issue of the snapper ban and whether 3 weeks is adequate consultation. Dave making his point clear on the text line, saying it's the 21st century. We don't need more data. We need a 10-year ban on snapper and other species now. Wake up and bite the bullet for the future. 0467 922 783, if you'd like to have your say. Well, let's stay on water now, because the complexity of water markets has long faced criticism throughout the Murray-Darling Basin. A failure to fully understand these markets and the prices on offer often leaves irrigators making poor and costly decisions. Well, the federal government hopes a new privately developed web and mobile app can help change that. Waterflow, as it's called, goes live today, and Brett Worthington is speaking here with one of its creators, Rod Carr.
Often irrigators were making decisions late or making decisions that weren't informed of the variety of options that they had available to them in terms of where they might be able to source their water from for their farming operations. So they tended to only look at the region that they were in, because that was the one they knew, without realising that there was opportunity to actually acquire water across other areas. So really, there was a time and at times cost implications for irrigators that meant they were buying water later than they needed to and at higher prices than they needed to.
So if someone was to use your website and the app that will come next, what is it that you hope they'll be able to get out of it?
Really, we hope that there's two things that they'll get out of it. One, we've built some pretty complex rules into the back of what we've developed so that the farmers don't need to get across that detail. Instead, they can just log into the website or the applications as when they're launched and do a search. And the search actually helps them to optimize their options available to them. So if they were looking to buy water or they were looking to sell water, they could do a search. What we've brought together is numerous points of information, not only prices, but also historical trade levels, storage levels, available allocation levels. So they can come to this as a point where they can do all of that research. And then if they decide to do a transaction, we've got a few intermediaries and brokers who are actually reporting already their bid spreads onto the site. So they can do some research across those parties immediately.
So for clarity, it's not a trading app or trading website per se, it's a bringing together of information?
No, absolutely, yes. But we're not a trading site and we will never be a trading site. This is a free source of information for irrigators where they can do their research. We couldn't be independent and a source of independent and trusted information if we were a trading site. So deliberately, this has been set up as an information aggregation site, basically a great place for irrigators to come and do their research.
It is a free service, like you mentioned. You received a federal government grant to help with the development. Yeah. Why do something if it's free?
This is something that we've wanted to do for a very long time, but it is expensive to put this sort of stuff together, and obviously to be able to offer it for free is not really the best commercial decision for an organisation to make. So the grant actually enabled us to do something that we'd wanted to do for a while, and when speaking to the government about it, we were sitting on a great deal of information that parties who are paying us could gain access to, but many others couldn't.
The government talks about, the thing that it's quite keen about is this accessing to real-time data. Why is real-time data important when you're buying and selling water?
Well, prices can change really, really quickly in the market. You know, in a matter of days, they can have jumped or have fallen depending on typically climatic, but also different sorts of announcements that can come into the market. So that's really important. But equally, this is a market that has a number of rules that affect connectivity and your ability to move water from one part of the Southern Basin, for instance, to another part. So understanding the nature of those limits means that they can be well informed on that side of things as well, because the rules are trigger-based rules that are changing subject to how water is being delivered through the basin. So not only is there the price situation, but there's also changing rules. You know, it doesn't make their decisions for them at the end of the day. Irrigators need to make their own decisions based on the information they have available to them. But saving them time and giving them confidence hopefully will make for a more effective outcome, particularly in times of drought.
That's Water Flow Director Rod Carr from Marsden Jacob Associates. He was speaking there with Brett Worthington. A web version of Water Flow goes live today, and then in a couple of weeks there'll be a mobile app version as well. Well, Riverland irrigators will pay lower consumption charges this year after 12 trusts voted on a pricing motion. The average drop in charges is $5.73 per megalitre. The Central Irrigation Trust's CEO, Gavin McMahon, says there's mixed feelings from trust members about water pricing.
The general meetings are generally for motions on business, but one of the legislative requirements that we have as an irrigation trust is that our pricing motions have to go up as a motion to a general meeting, and so we put those up at the AGM. So today we had the pricing motions for the coming year and all of the irrigators vote on those, and that was passed unanimously across all trusts.
And what were the details of that motion?
Yeah, it has the pricing structure for each of our trusts, and we run 12 trusts, so they're all slightly different in terms of pressure that we deliver and the like. But basically, on the whole, our service charges go up a small amount. I think it's about 50 cents per megalitre. But all the consumption charges come down quite significantly for the irrigation community. And that's a result of the energy contract that we've signed with Simex Zen. So that started off at the 1st of July this year. And that's been a really good contract that that we've taken out over a long period of time. And that's reflected in the pricing this year. So as a result of the savings we've made in that contract, we've been able to lower the consumption prices this year.
And how does that fit into the overall budget?
So CIT every year tries to budget for a surplus of around about $300,000, and that surplus provides for all of the capital expenditure that we need to do. So anything that we need to make an improvement that's capital-wise comes out of that $300,000. So the budget's set around that every year, and then we adjust the prices around that. So the thing that people have to remember is that the trusts are not-for-profit, so we're not out there to try and drive a large profit. We're actually out there to try and keep the prices as low as possible for our customers.
And what is grower sentiment at the moment in regards to water allocations? We are at 68% at the moment and expecting another update on the 2nd of September. What's the feeling around the different trusts at the moment?
Yeah, look, can I say there's a mixed view across the whole region. In fact, across the region, things are pretty people are reasonably confident, I guess, and I can say that in that commodity prices are all quite reasonable and certainly improved off a fairly low base. So there's a fair bit of good sentiment in the communities, but the current water price that's at $700+ per megalitre is certainly putting a damper on that. And particularly for people that have to lease water in. So they may have reduced their permanent allocation over time and now have to lease in at some significantly higher prices. And I guess that's the downside, and there are a number of people that are certainly trying to deal with that issue, and it's becoming very, very frustrating for them in a commodity where you probably won't make money if you have to lease in water at that value. So it's a mixed bag. You know, there's a lot of good things. A lot of people still own large portions of their water, but there's the other side of the coin where there's, concern from those that need to lease significant quantities.
And what else was discussed at the meeting?
We were asked a number of questions about what's driving the current water price and, things like the Inter-Valley trades and the trade restrictions on the Inter-Valley trades with the Goulburn and Murrumbidgee and the choke. So, it was information about the broader picture, but again, the only motion was for the pricing motion.
That's the CEO of the Central Irrigation Trust, Gavin McMahon, speaking with Grace Whiteside. And speaking of that allocation, the minimum water allocation for South Australian irrigators has risen now to 74% for 2019-20.
You're listening to the South Australian Country Hour on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
Where it is 27 past 12, and earlier we were talking about an app to help understand the water market. Well, 12 months on from launching an app to help oyster growers monitor their farms remotely, the developer says he has received plenty of positive feedback. Ken Rowe is an oyster grower himself on Kangaroo Island, but he used his background in IT to develop the MyShell Oyster Farm Management app. The app helps farmers manage tasks such as tracking the movement of stock, recording stock sold, and keeping a record of any mortalities of stock. Mr. Rowe says he's starting to see more growers using it.
Yeah, the uptake's been good. We have around 30 South Australian growers on, and now a few from Tasmania as well. And there's a bunch that are really keen to get on with the next release.
For people that might not have heard about MyShell, what's the app used for?
So MyShell is a farm management app that helps oyster growers and other shellfish farmers down the track to manage their stock. It's a decision-making tool so that they can improve their stock management and ultimately productivity and profitability on their farms.
So I guess essentially also you're saying that if they're not at the farm, they can still check in on it. So if they're at a conference like this, they can still keep an eye on the farm.
Yeah, so MyShell also has been designed to be a platform for bigger things down the track. So using what they call Industry 4.0 technology, what I like to call Aquaculture 4.0 technology, which is cloud-based, collaborative tools, then you can do a whole lot more. Farmers can remotely check on their farms. And we can incorporate or integrate other data sensors and probes and things into the system, so we can collect a whole lot of data that we couldn't collect before, which can help farmers make better decisions.
What's the feedback been like from growers who are using this?
Yeah, pretty good. There's been very good feedback, actually. I'm probably the biggest critic. I'm the one that gives the negative feedback, because I think it still needs a bit of improvement, or it has needed a bit of improvement on its user interface. So the next release is called version 1.3, which fixes up all that. So I'm busting to get that next version out there, because it looks so much nicer and easy to use.
When you first come up with this idea, is it essentially what you thought it would be this time, 12 months on?
Yeah, I guess it is. It's probably taken 12 months longer than the plan was. But the industry as a group sat down and said we need better data going forward for farm management to improve our industry. So that's what it was about, is collecting that data and using that data. So we've finally, really, a year later than I hoped, but we've finally got to that point where we now have that platform, and now we can do the really exciting stuff, actually, and build on that and do some really super smart farming.
As an oyster grower yourself, do you find that you're saving time with it, or even things like, you know, fuel with having to get out to your oyster leases and stuff like that?
Yeah, absolutely. Probably the biggest thing for me and a few others that I know is that they manage their farm remotely. So one of my mates is in Bali at the moment or somewhere. And of course, I spend a lot of time working on this app now. So I've got a farm manager, and I only talk to him once a week, but I can see what he's doing, and we communicate using that app. And we stick to our schedule based on that. So that's one of the biggest things for me. It's actually got me off the farm.
How is oyster growing going on KI at the moment?
We are so looking forward to spat coming through thick and fast now. It's been a long couple of years with a spat shortage, but there's definitely a lot at the end of the tunnel. We've used this opportunity to play around with Angazis and different species on Kangaroo Island, and we've changed a few things. So we're really looking forward to next year when the spat's on and growing again, perhaps in a, you know, with a slightly different model.
That's Ken Rowe, an oyster grower on Kangaroo Island, but also the developer of the MyShell Oyster Farm Management app. And he was speaking there with Brooke Neindorf. And more text coming through on the proposed snapper ban we heard earlier from the York Peninsula Mayor, because that council has written a letter to the Premier stating their opposition to the proposed plans to ban snapper fishing for 3 years. This text saying, how about banning professional fishermen from catching snapper and letting recreational fishers catch one per person and a maximum of three per boat? But then we had a commercial fisherman from Port Victoria call in to say, why are there so many snapper at the market if there's such a shortage? The restrictions on snapper fishing are destroying this fisherman's business, and he says that he doesn't know what he will do and that he fishes sustainably. So two sides to that debate. 0467 922 783, if you'd like to have your say. You can also give us a call on 1300 222 891. And still to come on the Country Hour, we will be talking. Well, we'll be looking a little bit into the future and the idea of popping a broccoli peel or a Brussels sprout peel, and how that's going to help the horticulture industry with their waste problem. John in Mount Gambier has texted to say the broccoli peels, well, the Jetsons also told us we have flying cars in the future. Where's our hoverboards? Thanks for your text, John. We've seen already the broccoli powder in coffees and visuals of carrot powder. So I don't think it'd be too hard maybe to put that powder into a capsule, but we'll have more on that soon. Right now, though, let's head off to the Weather Bureau. And it's good afternoon to senior forecaster Vince Rollins. Hi, Vince.
How's it going?
Not too bad. It was it was a very warm last day of winter on the weekend on Saturday. Is there any spring rain coming our way?
Yeah, look, we did get a little bit of activity over the weekend, and we've got some mid-level clouds sort of hanging over the central and southeastern districts at the moment. That's producing a little bit of rainfall, but just having a look at some of the falls that we did get across the state over the weekend up until about 9 a.m. this morning, just general falls of around 5 to 10 in some locations. So if we look at the West Coast, Streaky Bay got just over 7 millimetres, Woodney just over 7. Around the Eastern Eyre Peninsula, we had falls up to about 5 to 7 millimetres as well. Pretty similar in the mid-north and in the lower Eyre Peninsula, not as much. That mid-level band that produced some thunderstorms just went through central parts of Eyre Peninsula. So they got up to about 3. Around the Mount Lofty Ranges, up to about 10. And then if we include the activity that we saw around yesterday, around the southeast, we've got some falls up to about around the 5 to 10 through that region and over York Peninsula as well. So a bit of activity particularly over the southern parts of the state over the weekend. And as I said, there's still a little bit more going on at the moment, really not much in it. We've had some falls over Kangaroo Island, up to about 3 millimetres, and in the tip of York Peninsula, Stenhouse Bay's had 1.6. But we are expecting that to continue to move eastwards and clear during this afternoon. And then as we head into tomorrow, we do have a bit of a weak trough just sitting over the northwest pastoral district, but we're not expecting much activity associated with that. We could see a little bit of fog around tomorrow morning with the just sort of light winds and clear skies. But as we head into tomorrow late afternoon and evening, we start to see a bit of mid-level cloud developing over the far west around the sort of Nullarbor Plain area. And then by around midnight, should extend over Eyre Peninsula and perhaps some of the central districts. And then as we progress into Wednesday, we start to see that mid-level cloud really thicken up and start to produce some showers. And it's associated with a mid-level jet that's moving over the area. Now, exactly how much we get out of this mid-level system moving through is still a little bit up in the air. I mean, there's some indications that we could get some falls over 10 millimetres, but I think that's maybe pushing the limits a bit. So we're basically looking at a band extending across the south of Eyre Peninsula right across to the eastern border, and it's a little bit of a weak trough pushing over the southeast as well. So anywhere south of probably Woodner to maybe the south of the Riverland is likely to get some falls. Probably thinking some areas might get around 5 millimetres, maybe a touch more in some locations. But yeah, that's a little bit of a tricky one as it completely depends on how this mid-level cloud develops. So yeah, looking at Wednesday with a little bit of interest. And then as we head into the latter part of the week, so from Thursday, we'll still see some showers continuing over the agricultural area, possibly a little bit of thunderstorm activity in the far west coastal fringes as we get a low pressure system and associated cold front just moving across the far west. The low develops south of Eyre Peninsula, so that's going to really drive the weather late Thursday into Friday. So we are expecting quite a bit of shower activity over the agricultural area and possibly reaching the south of the pastoral districts during Friday. Could see some thunderstorm activity about southern parts as well. And again, see how this low develops is really going to drive how much rainfall we do get. But it looks like around the Adelaide Mount Lofty ranges are likely to see the highest falls through that Friday period. And then as we head into the weekend, just looking at another high pressure system moving across from the west, so we see winds starting to ease off just in a southwesterly airstream. So some showers about the southern agricultural area, but we will see some pretty clear skies inland, so looking at some very cold conditions and probably some inland frost during that Saturday, Sunday, Monday period. So really just over the next week, Wednesday is an interesting day with that mid-level cloud band. Friday, with that low pressure system and front moving through, is going to generate quite a bit of wind and quite a bit of rainfall as well. So we'll see how those two systems pan out. But other than that, basically just looking at fairly typical sort of late winter, early spring conditions. As far as rainfall goes, that's a really tricky one due to the nature of the two systems coming through. So generally, I think over the southern agricultural area, we'll be looking at falls of around the sort of 5 to 10 millimetre mark. Generally, as we go further north, we'll see those falls become less the further north we go. And then over the Mount Lofty Ranges, I mean, we could see falls up to about 20 millimetres, but if this low continues to develop, that total could go up quite significantly. So a couple of things to keep an eye on. We don't have any warnings out at the moment, but certainly as we head into Thursday, Friday, I think we'll see some coastal wind warnings and possibly some severe weather warnings as well. But keep an eye on the Bureau's webpage for any updates to warnings over the next few days. And obviously, listening to the Country Hour, we get a bit of a feel for what the conditions are over the next several days as well. So, yeah, really just that Wednesday, Friday, a couple of days of interest, and other days just some general showers and some cold nights heading our way for the weekend.
Thanks for that. Vince, we might have to get you to write our promos for us. Okay, with that one. Thank you.
Okay, cheers.
Wednesday looking like the best day for picking up some rain for people, so we'll keep a watch out for that. Let's have a look at the far west of New South Wales now, and for the Upper Western District, a sunny day with overnight temperatures falling to between 5 and 12 and daytime temperatures reaching the low 30s. For the Lower Western District, a sunny day with overnight temperatures falling to between 7 and 11 and daytime temperatures again getting up and reaching around the 30 degree mark, so definitely heating up over there. Another text in on the snapper ban. Bill saying that a ban for 3 years is okay as long as there are no exceptions. It must be statewide to make it fair on everyone. And I think what Bill is referring to there is how the government has these two plans, and in one of them there is an exception for the southeast.
A true refugee.
Evenings with Peter Gers.
But you'd corresponded with an Adelaide woman.
What happened?
A pen pal.
One day I opened the local rag and there was a letter to the editor from Australia looking for a correspondent.
Weeknights from 7.
Have you been to Armenia?
Yes, I've been 3 times.
Did you feel a stranger there?
Yes and no. I missed Adelaide.
Peter Gers.
On ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
On ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill, this is the South Australian Country Hour.
Where it is 19 minutes to 1. My name is Isabella Pittaway. Well, let's have a look at the winter that was, because the Bureau has been crunching the numbers around that, and someone who is all across that is Senior Climatologist Darren Ray. Hi, Darren.
Hi there, how are you going?
Good, thanks. Unfortunately, it's been the driest winter since 2007 and the 10th driest on record, but that's based on averages. What does that mean when you break it down across the state?
It's certainly been a bit of a mixed picture across the state, but I guess it's fair to say it has tended a drier winter for most parts of the state. I mean, it started in quite a promising way. We had a relatively wet May, and then June came in tending a little bit wet around the state as well. So it started quite a promising manner for the cropping season. But we actually had a very dry July and August, and that's pretty typical of the climate influence we're seeing around at the moment with the positive phase of the inundation dipole climate influence. So that typically goes through June to October, but gains increasing influence as you go through July, August, September. That's certainly what we've seen this winter. So that influence kicking in as we went through winter, and so July, quite a dry and warm July and August through the through winter. So a fairly mixed picture. The rainfall, if you look around the state, the pastoral areas don't get a lot of rainfall through winter, but they saw a particularly dry winter this year. Their winter rainfall was tended to be about 60, 70, 80% of the average across their peninsula. Fairly dry overall across Kangaroo Island and the York Peninsula, whereas over in the eastern districts, the Mallee and the southeast actually tended up with rainfall that was a little bit closer to average for winter, if not a little bit above in some parts.
And what effect has the winter had on the northern drought?
Well, I mean, it's certainly, as I mentioned, it's really quite been quite a dry. It was particularly dry across the pasture regions. As I mentioned, not a time of year when they normally expect to get a lot of rainfall anyway. But even so, the rainfall was winter rainfall was the lowest 10% or even lowest on record in some parts of the pastoral regions. Some locations had their record driest winter rainfall. But temperatures a little bit of a mixed bag. Tending to be warm days and some frosty nights in there across the state. So temperatures a bit below average for nighttime temperatures and above average for daytime temperatures. So a warmer winter during the day, frosty nights and drier than average, and all very typical, as I mentioned, of that positive Indian Ocean dipole influence.
Darren, thanks for your time in the Country Hour today.
No worries, thank you.
That was senior climatologist Darren Ray. It is 15 minutes to one on the Country Hour, and the problem of waste has long plagued the horticulture industry. Up to one third of our fruit and vegetable crops are discarded before reaching supermarket shelves. But now scientists, farmers and processors across the country say they're the closest they've ever been to solving the problem. So what's the solution? It's the growing demand for nutrient-rich powders and supplements made from vegetables. National, regional and rural reporter Jess Davis takes a look into the future.
The idea of food in pill form has been around since the early days of science fiction. In the groundbreaking 1930s film Just Imagine, the main character wakes up after a 50-year coma to find meals have been replaced with pills.
Here you are, boy. Wrap yourself around that. Eat it.
Well, how was it? The roast beef was a little bit tough.
But a meal in a pill is no longer just a prop in a science fiction film. Farmers could soon be producing broccoli and cauliflower pills, one serve of vegetables in a tiny capsule.
It's pretty big ask to say to someone, here, just take this pill and it's a broccoli pill, but in the future, who knows?
The food of the future starts here, on John Said's farm at Werribee, on the outskirts of Melbourne, where cauliflowers and broccolis are currently being picked. Like most fruit and vegetable farms, not everything is harvested. Around 15% of these crops are simply left on the ground.
So, John, how recently was this crop harvested?
Sure, so we harvested this crop yesterday, Jess. Whilst it looks like we've cut all of it, you can still see there is some crop left. Good example is right here. You know, probably not much wrong with this apart from a little bit out the side here, but it just won't be any good for retail.
John Said produces vegetables on 2,000 hectares across the country. His company is Australia's largest supplier of lettuce, along with vegetables including broccoli, broccolini, cauliflower, cabbages and Brussels sprouts. He hopes to be harvesting and selling 100% of his crops in the not-too-distant future by turning the waste into powder.
We've always thought about food waste, exactly, and we've always thought about yield, but we've never been able to truly get a market. I think now we're the closest we've ever been to be able to address an issue like that.
It's all been made possible by the CSIRO, which runs a food innovation lab a few kilometres up the road. Its scientists approached John Said a couple of years ago with an idea. They wanted to turn his vegetable waste into powder. Project leader Luz Sangwansri says they decided to start with broccoli.
Broccoli is one of the most nutritious vegetables we have, and it's very high in protein. So we thought that's a good start.
It took 18 months to develop a powder that contains nearly all the same nutrients and health benefits as fresh broccoli.
It is important because the process that we apply, whether we heat or we shred, can affect the nutritional content of the finished product.
Then came the process of turning the powder into something people would want to eat.
Okay, should we taste this broccoli latte?
Yes, let's do it.
So what's the nutritional value?
So what we are trying to do is make coffee more healthier by adding broccoli powder in it. And while you're sipping away your coffee, you can have some of your snacks with a dip or have a muffin. And altogether, you'll increase your vegetable intake by having that.
The CSIRO is talking to a number of food companies to get these products onto supermarket shelves. It hopes it can happen in the next 12 months. In the meantime, it's conducted a widespread survey of farmers, processors and packers to find out how much is wasted and where. It found 1.5 million tonnes of fruit and vegetables are lost before they get to retailers, and most of it happens around prime horticultural areas. Running the survey was CSIRO scientist Pablo Giuliano.
From the national map that we have done, we have identified key regions of the losses and the waste where Australia is generating in fruits and vegetables. So now the idea is to locate and build facilities for processing where we can turn this waste into ingredients.
At CSIRO, we're revolutionising the supply chain by creating a food loss bank. Our food loss bank will form a decentralised network.
Work is already underway in Gippsland in Victoria and Townsville in North Queensland to start developing these facilities.
I don't think this is futuristic. I think this is happening now. The business models are in place to make it happen soon.
At Echuca in northern Victoria, tomato and carrot processor Kagomi is already on board, spurred on by the need to generate a bit of extra income.
We really don't have the options with rising costs. We really need to do something with our waste and we need to do it quickly.
Brad Free is the General Manager of Operations. The company processes 18,000 tonnes of carrots every year, but up to a quarter of that usually ends up as waste. So it's developed a food product out of the carrot fibre, but believes the future is in nutraceuticals, a term coined in the 80s by mashing the words nutrition and pharmaceutical together.
Currently we're supplying carrot fibre into some meat manufacturers that are using for meat patties and going into sausages and those types of things. We're actually taking some prime beef out of the product, and then we're also looking at the nutraceutical market, but obviously that's a longer lead time market to travel down.
Nutraceutical company Swiss is working with John Said, encapsulating omega-3 into broccoli powder. But head of industry development Justin Howden is careful to keep the details under wraps.
One of the things that's attractive about the local ingredients potential is that it's really pan-Australia. It covers most of the states, most of the territories. All of them have specific areas that we could probably pioneer some great new extracts for the industry.
It's unlikely a pill will replace food anytime soon, but there's no doubt what we think food is and how we consume it is changing, and farmers like John Said are keen to be involved from the ground up.
You know, my dream is that we've got a salt and pepper shaker and a broccoli and cauliflower shaker right next to it so that you can just, you know, 2-3 shakes and there's a serve of veg. And it really creates the opportunity to, as I put it, vegetables reimagined and hopefully increase vegetable consumption, which is a good thing.
It's a bit Willy Wonka, isn't it? That's Victorian farmer John Said ending that report from Jess Davis. And if you missed Landline, you can catch up on that story on ABC iView. Well, staying with horticulture, and it's been 2.5 years since tomato potato psyllid, or TPP, was first discovered in Australia over in WA. Well, agencies are yet to find the pest in eastern states or the bacteria that it can carry, which causes zebra chip disease. If they did, potato growers would have to shell out thousands of dollars per hectare in chemical costs, just like farmers in New Zealand. Callum Fletcher is the biosecurity coordinator with AusVeg, and he explained to Larissa Smith what their surveillance has uncovered so far.
Since the first detection in West Australia in February 2017, the West Australian Government, Department of Primary Industries, DPIRD, has been conducting a series of surveillance throughout winter and summer periods to look for presence of the bacteria, the zebra chip causing bacteria. They've done that each summer season and not found any evidence that it is present. Now, they've found plenty of psyllids, but no evidence of that bacteria. Other states in the east have also conducted surveillance activities. They've put yellow sticky traps out in major production regions and the major cities and urban environments to make sure that when they say that they do not have the tomato potato psyllid, that they have evidence to prove that that is so. And so far, they have all been able to prove that it is not present in the eastern states.
Is that a bit of a rare case for the psyllid to be in a country but not to be carrying the bacteria?
Yes. Currently, Australia is the only known country where the psyllid is present and the bacteria is not. Other countries, such as the United States or Mexico or New Zealand, the bacteria has been associated with the presence of the psyllid.
So what environment is in place for that to happen?
A guess would be potentially that only a small number of psyllids actually got into West Australia. Usually in its in the natural environment, only about 3 to 5% of psyllids are actually positive for the bacteria, have it in their system. So if those psyllids that did come into West Australia were not positive and they bred and they are the basis for the population that we currently have, that may be a reason why.
Could the bacteria come at a later date at some point? What would have to happen?
Well, that's certainly a great risk, and the bacteria, CLSO, is regarded as one of the top pests and diseases that the Australian government is concerned about solely for that fact. So it's still on the top 42 list that the Federal Department of Agriculture has for high priority pests. If another incursion were to happen, now we have a infrastructure or population throughout parts of Australia of the psyllid which carries it. So the bacteria would then be able to be spread by any one of those psyllids. So certainly it puts us at a higher risk than previously when we didn't have the psyllid.
That's Biosecurity Coordinator with AusVeg, Callum Fletcher. Well, there aren't many opportunities to dress up for a formal event in Tibooburra, so the return of the Tibooburra Country Women's Association Ball on Saturday night was a welcome relief for many locals and the not-so-local. There were people who travelled hundreds of kilometres to be there, and Broken Hill rural reporter Saskia Mabin was one of them.
It's been 2 years since the small town of Tibooburra, with a population of less than 200 people, celebrated a Country Women's Association Ball. On Saturday night, locals, station owners and visitors, some from many hundreds of kilometres away, dressed up for a cocktail evening with a touch of outback style to commemorate 82 years of the Tibooburra CWA branch. The president of the association, Rachel Hill, said the community's positive response to the event was overwhelming.
We've had such a great show. Like, we've got over 92 adults come along, and over 30 kids and a lot of little young bubbas. So it's, yeah, amazing. The hall is full.
And everyone seems really excited and happy to be here. Do these sorts of things come up very often? Do you get many opportunities to dress up and go out?
No, I think back a long time ago, there used to be not necessarily just the CWA, but different organisations in the community would hold different balls and things like that. And if it wasn't a ball, it would be a dance, so a bit more of a casual sort of thing. As a community, we just thought, with the mental health issues and with, like, you know, just trying to get people together for a good cause, we thought, why not bring them back? And I think it's so nice to see people make the effort to, you know, make themselves feel special by getting dressed up and coming along to something like this. So, yeah, I think we'll keep doing them. They're so popular. Well, this one's so popular, so I think we'll do another one next year.
You've got the kids and the family here as well, so this isn't just for the adults. It's a whole family affair, right?
Definitely. I mean, me personally, I love taking my kids wherever we go. They just seem to fit in with whatever we're doing, so it's great. We love bringing the kids along and making them a part of it. I always remember when I was a little kid coming to these kinds of things, and Mum would make me a dress and all that sort of thing. So it was really special to me that I could bring my boys along.
CWA member Amy Huff spent a fair bit of time driving around town in the lead up to the ball, collecting 1 ton of gum leaves to decorate the hall. She said these sorts of social events are important for the town during tough times.
This year we've had quite a few events in Tibooburra, so it's really good to see the town come together and have a few different things on, like drive-ins, gymkhanas, golf days, balls. I think we're going to try and plan a Halloween party as well. Just all different things, all different committees. So it's really good to see the town come together for different things and just have fun, especially in this tough time of the drought and everything like that as well.
Absolutely. And it's a small community here, but I feel like everyone's really there for each other. How would you describe the Tibooburra community?
It is very strong. It is very supportive. I've been here pretty much all my life. I know everybody. Every time someone's going through a hard time, they all sort of come together. They're good mates, good friends, willing to do anything to help out. Just genuine, good people.
Amy's six-year-old daughter Dakota was one of about 30 children in attendance.
What are you enjoying most about the night?
Spending time with my friends and making friends.
But not everybody was preoccupied with food and socialising. Edward Hill was busy collecting cans to save up for another pet rabbit.
I'm going to trade him in for money. I'm going to get a boy, breed him up.
The next morning, Edward Hill was running down the main street still collecting cans, while locals gathered for breakfast and others began the journey home.
Oh, all the best to him. That's Saskia Mabin with that report from Tibberborough. Sounds like they had a really, really fun night. That is all we've got time for on the Country Hour this Monday. abc.net.au/rural for more stories from across the country.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.